I'm John Beck, and I co-direct with my colleague Kurt Dewhurst our Daily Work of Data Lives, which for around 23 years now here on campus has tried to look at the intersection of culture and work from a variety of different perspectives. We've done that through sponsoring poetry and fiction readings, exhibits, concerts, film openings, and this is the 20th year of our Brown Bag series. So I'll just send some of those around. Next Friday, this very room, Tom Klug will come in from Mary Grove College History Department to talk about anything but United, Detroit employers, workers, and the open shop, 1904 through 1907. Then, the following Monday, Brooke Bolton is going to be here. She finished her PhD in English and was connected for a while up at Michigan Tech. She's currently in the English department at Rainy River Community College, which is out in the Badlands somewhere. And she's going to be talking about a Finnish voice for labor, Aku Paavo's poetry and the immigrant working class. And that'll be on the 9th. Then, last but not least, toward the end of the month, on November 23rd, also on Monday, Heather Pristash is coming back, and she's been in our program before. And she's interesting because of the fact that she's done work on protest knitting, which is kind of an interesting whole area. And her presentation is going to be called A Handmade Response to Sweatshops, Craftivism, as it's called, Protest and the Critique of Consumer Culture, and that's on Monday, November 23rd. Then I would commend to you, if you haven't been down to the gallery to see the exhibit already, down there there's copies of this same flyer, but do take one now if you'd like it, which is all the upcoming things that we have coming up in relation to the exhibit, Iron Hulls and Turbulent Waters, including on the anniversary of the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald, a program on November 10th over at the MSU Library on the fourth floor in what's called the Green Room. Tuesday, November 17th, a book signing by Robert Campbell talking about his book, Classic Ships of the Great Lakes. And we have an ongoing brother-sister kind of exhibit that Tom Volkanen has put together from the MSU Library on books and other materials over on the third floor of the library, and I would commend that to you. There are two additional poems of Cindy Hunter Morgan that are in that exhibit, along with the two that we have. I'll send those around. So, that gets us to today's program, if I can get that out. I had a wonderful time yesterday at the opening and afterward with Jim Brozek. And Jim is here really to tell us a very, very interesting personal story, which is what it means to both work on the one side, but have your camera with you when you go to work, to capture your own experience and the experience of others on the job. So Jim worked for a space of years, which he'll tell you about, in winter repair in the port of Milwaukee on Jones Island, where they would park these immense ore carriers and they would be scraped and re-welded and various other pieces of maintenance were done on them during that time. But then in the off season, talking about the off season of winter being summer, after all, the off season, he would actually be on a ranch in New Mexico, if I remember rightly. And he's going to share some of those photos as well. Jim currently is a photographer, professional photographer on the staff at the University, Marquette University School of Dentistry. And so we are so happy that he helped us really officially kick off the exhibit yesterday, even though it's been up for a few weeks. And he's going to talk today on capturing the iron hulls from the inside, worker, photographer, photographer, worker. So please join me in welcoming James Brozek to our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives.
Hello, hello, okay.
The ranch stuff is on a different slide presentation that I can go to if we have enough time to look at it, but we'll spend time on this. Little background, I was a business major. My final year, I think, I got a little bit disappointed. I liked photography, so I spent many hours late at night looking at photographic books in the UWM library, and I fell in love with a lot of documentary work, photographers like Lewis Hine, Eugene Smith, who's a light photographer, and of course, Wisconsin's own Lewis Hine, who documented the Empire State Building being built, stuff like that. So, being stimulated by that, I involved myself and avoided getting a real job and traveled around as an itinerant laborer for about 10 years. And got involved in these work environments, invited into one in the ranch, needing a job during the Reagan era. My girlfriend's brother was the port captain down on Jones Island running the repair of these boats, so he accepted me, and after taking pictures and sticking them on the bulletin boards and giving the guys a little kick of that I can do both work and photograph, I wound up over the next 4 or 5 winters doing that. And so and I'll tell you, it was really interesting when I graduated from with my bachelor's and I went in, I took 1 year in photography. I went down to those docks and I was photographing. And there were a bunch of deckhands that chased me away and threw rocks at me. And so I said, and I wound up coming back to it, like 5 years later, and was all mine. So that was kind of a curious thing. So anyway, these boats are worked on during the winter time, and the thing that continued to amaze me and make me enthused about going to work was that it was a giant playground for me. A kid in an erector set, except I'm small and the erector set is really large. And so I was fascinated with that, and also at the same time creating my own vision of how I wanted to photograph and the images I wanted to do, all at the same time doing the same work as them, because you know if I didn't do the same work as them, they'd probably knock me out. But anyway, you can see in the wintertime the ice is frozen around these boats. The boats are dead in the water, cold. The ice is there during the wintertime, but you'll see some images of when the ice goes out or it's a warm winter and we're painting them the other way. Most of the stuff that we did was painting and then all the other dirty work to help support the guys who are, say, replacing the boilers or moving the hoist for the booms off and stuff, but you'll see. But this gives you an example of the conditions that we were painting in. You can see it was a nice snowstorm had happened the night before. You can see the drifts piling off the top. And you wonder, well, how do you put paint on those boats? And what we would do is take 30 gallons drums of marine hull enamel and we put in 5 gallons of Penetrol to loosen it all up, make sure that it stayed rollable at like 0 degrees. But the reason they did it is because that's the only time you can really paint these boats, because when they're underway, nobody does any kind of maintenance like that. So every captain likes to go out with a nice maroon ship. And the one on the left is, I'm up on top over there looking down. That could be me up there, this laser pointer right up there, but it's not me. But I'm looking down, that's the perspective. The way we would move the scaffolding, we'd build the scaffolding, put skis on the bottom of it, and push along the side of the boat. And we'd do the same thing on the other side, on the shore side. This is another example of how tiny we are and how, you know, if you wanted to be awed by something magnificent and large, this 1,000-footer, you can see how small we are in here. We're on our way back to either take a break or at lunchtime. Probably at the end of the day, we're bringing our rollers back. And of course, the guys that I work with are a bunch of clowns. They were hired by the port captain, and they're mostly his friends. And so, you know, there's a lot of horseplay when you're in a place like that to break up the monotony, especially the monotony of painting. And so at times, the guys would break into some sort of craziness and was able to photograph some of it. Even when I ask them to do a little group portrait, it collapses into a little fight and they fall into a pile up. And walking back, this gives you an idea of the how thick the ice is. And after that snowstorm, and we got plenty of snow that year, but the ice was so thick and smooth, and some of them were body surfing on their flotation devices. Here is on the dock side, moving along, doing the same thing. Again, it was the monotonous feeling, and in a way to make it enjoyable, I guess, for me, there was a rhythm. You get a rhythm into rolling, especially with a long, sometimes 24-foot long roller pole. And you rock into it and rock back, and then to bring the pole down, you have to pull it really quickly so that it'll balance it, dip it into the paint thing, and then quickly run it back up. But you can see the very amazing thing about these long stretches of wall of steel. I have to say that there are sometimes, here's a guy in between two ships. You can see the cracked ice down here and barges off in the distance that we'll see operating at some later point. But sometimes you think, well, does it make any sense to paint below the waterline? Well, you do it, but when it starts rubbing up against docks and all this paint, it generally gets rubbed off. The paint at the tip top never seems to get rubbed off. In years and years and years, it bubbles, and you have like 10 layers of paint, and it's coming off. And so up there, you really have to work hard to scrape this stuff off before you paint. Another thing that I found pretty truly amazing is these huge propellers, being so close to them and being able to walk up to them on frozen concrete water. You know, you're completely satisfied, completely safe, but at another time, these things are submerged. The ship is floating when it comes in, and then they blow all their ballast, they rise up as high as they can, and then they're tied next to each other. Their anchors are taken out of the water, put on the dock side by cranes, and they're locked in for the winter, and the ice freezes up next to it and holds them pretty steady. But when things are thawing, the river comes back to a water state, and then they rub against each other a little bit depending upon how much water surges in and out of the harbor. And in fact, one time during a storm, these boats that were tied up next to each other, they were rocking and rolling in opposite directions or in opposite harmonics, and the winches had to be on automatic payout and take up. And so you'd be on the stern going down, and the one next to you is on the stern going up. Yeah, they take in a lot of water into their ballast tanks to bring them back down to sailing level, and then they blow that ballast when they take on the oar. And I found this kind of interesting. I imagined that maybe this ship was going through the Arctic, but actually this is just snow that has been piled on the side of the dock. And the draft marks are something that are always painted just to help everybody know how much water you're drawing. Here's just the rafts that we would work off of when the river was unfrozen are fairly small, but still we built scaffolding four high on these things. And it's pretty interesting when you have a scaffolding at four high and the river is rocking and rolling, and it takes a little while to get some sea legs. And then when you're pushing your roller against the ship, you're actually pushing the top of the scaffolding off a little bit. And then you get this sort of like rocking motion going on, and when it rocks in towards the ship, you can reach a little bit higher. And every time we finish a section, we untie the cleats, move further along. There's someone up on the deck that is moving the lines along also. There's a 30-gallon drum of paint there. We had just finished this one. And this was, you talk about sailors learning sailor knots. I only learned one. And I still use it today, the bowlines. You guys familiar with the bowlines? Yeah, there's a couple of ways you can tie it, but they always said the rabbit comes out of the hole, around the tree, and back into the hole. That's how you sort of figure it out. Of course, the reflections, the light, the immenseness. I mean, I loved hiking in canyon lands and in the being surrounded in slot canyons and stuff. And so these ships sort of remind me of being next to these formations. Again, everything is sort of jerry-rigged, and you do the best you can. Here's a raft in, pulled in, and the guy is tying off the ladder to those little things up here. So as the raft rocks a little bit, it won't pull away from the ship itself so that you can actually get the draft marks painted. This is up on top of the raft looking down, and you see there aren't any really handholds. So you have to be sort of a little bit of a monkey to be crawling around here. Over here, someone's just fooling around, tapping this guy's head, who's on the level just below. So all this stuff, when you build the scaffolding, you put the wood up, the planks up, and everything is sort of like not tied down necessarily, but it's tied down by your weight standing on it. Oops. I like this picture a lot because of ships are nothing but chains and gantlings and lines, and especially seeing these guys up on the painting the name on the Callaway. They're hanging over the side. They put down a plank with a couple of iron hooks to hold on to it, and they throw a Jacobson ladder over the side, and you peel down. You have a harness on, supposedly, but still, 40 feet above the water or the rocks or whatever, it's and the wind whistling by you. It's kind of crazy and fun and thrilling. Danger, danger. Anyway, and Tommy Balestrieri was the fellow that hired me, my ex-girlfriend's brother, and that's him hauling that raft over to this position. And again, the raft, this is looking down from the bow of either the spear or the gat, and moving the lines around. I was up on top this time, moving the lines so that we could tie the rafts up close to the ship. And you maneuver around the anchor chains. But you can see it's lots of up and down. And this is our little raft on the way from one job to the next ship. It's kind of cute, isn't it? And you can see the Callaway is now on the outside, so this was a different year. The other year, it was on the inside. And I think that because it was, let me go back here. It was tied up. The Callaway is a AAA, and there's the Firbird and the Boris were AAs. And to help to get the ships to carry more, they would cut them in half and build in another section to make them longer. And so that the Callaway became a AAA. I mean, did they ever have just an A? Oh, they must have been pretty tiny.
All about it goes in an accounting way. So like there was the first class was the A's for like 1920s, and you wanted the double A's, which were the Orhees and the Olds and all the rest of that.
Oh, the Olds, yeah.
For the 50s.
Yeah, well, the Fairless was a double A, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's, anyway, pretty interesting.
Owned by a company?
U.S. Steel, I believe, owned them. And U.S. Steel went through lots of changes. And ultimately, halfway through the time when I was working there, they changed the name from U.S. Steel to USS Great Lakes Fleet. The thousand footers were.
Right. All the thousand footers came out of
Bay. Oh, okay. It's interesting that the God and the Spirit that I was on, walking through the ships, they have very different. They look exactly alike, except that I learned when they were hauling the pistons out to be redone and to have the cylinders reground, one of them didn't have rails, and they had to use the you had to move the pistons with chain falls to get the pistons out. But other ones, they just hoisted up and just rolled it. So that it's as if they learned something from the workers. They said, "Oh, this is horrible." And here's a buddy of mine. We're up here. We're actually painting the John G. Munson from the Gray Fleet. I don't know there's a difference in the two fleets.
Yeah.
Right, and downstairs, the Bradley wreck, I was mentioning to someone that there's a wonderful book called Fire and Ice, and I think that the Bradley was the ice one where it went down. I think maybe only three guys survived, and the fire part of the book was the fire in Peshtigal that happened that was really devastating. Lots of people died, but it happened at the same time as the Chicago fire, so it didn't really make the news. But you can see, you're up there, and if you wiggle back and forth, even though you're tied off, there is a sense of, you could be sleeping on El Capitan. You know, these guys who do these rock climbing, they probably have it more comfortable. And here, this guy, Keith Orlowski, they call him Kale, and he was giving me a really tough little look, and then he couldn't stand it any longer, and he started laughing. This is my old girlfriend's brother. He is still running a show down there to take care of these ships. And during the summer and stuff, he captains his own tug called Leona, named after his mother. So, and he hauls coal to and from the power plant and does other stuff. But this fellow, John, if ever you want to, this guy has so many, many, many stories. And he's Italian, and he can tell them with such great color. And he knew lots of these ex-captains who have passed away and told him the stories. Because he used to tell us, at the end of the day, we're in the shanty, downing Pabst Blue Ribbon or something, start talking. It was pretty interesting. But this is on the wheelhouse, would you call it? Or of either the Spear or the God. Couple of portraits. This is a good friend of mine, Stan the Man Unusual, they called him. SMU for short. Because when he first showed up for work, he had the combat boots on, and he had a red beret, which was like... And so, it takes a while for the guys to get used to these new characters that come in. But as long as you pull it, they broke these two ships apart so that we could go down through the center of it with the raft and paint the interior of these. And that's kind of strange because, I don't know how many brain cells I have left, but when you're painting walls on either side and the stuff is evaporating and the smells. And another curious thing, when we're painting the side of the thousand footers and it's morning, the sun's on the other side, this stuff is going on and it's not drying, but it's just laying there. All of a sudden, hot sun, even though it's winter, is shining off of this steel, and the fumes that would come off it were incredible. Anyway, this is, I don't think there was any OSHA involved in that. So. These are from the boilers, I believe, and you can see the fins around there that disperse the heat into the water to help it to boil. But every so often, they have to replace all those. They have to replace the fire brick. And all that comes out, and they redo the whole boilers. But these things are so heavy, you can't really pick one up by yourself. So it's manning it into a dumpster. And even to get the dumpster, you need someone up there to flip it all the way in. So we hauled tons of those out. And of course, they have a dumpster that is hauled up on deck by a crane, and then it removes it for scrap metal. And this is some other tubing that we were moving from the outer ships over to here. This is something one year, the final year I was there, that I was lucky to see these hydraulic booms that go out, and they lift the boom and that turns and sends the ore out over the side into whatever they put it in. But the idea that in order to remove it from here, from the top, you have to slowly take this plug out. And you can see that you have to do it slowly and inch it, and they're constantly greasing it to make sure that it slides. But you can't take it, they leave the plug in the one side so that they don't want to take it completely out, because I suppose it's somewhat like pulling a steering wheel off, you know, if you have some device. But you take it, it took maybe 3 or 4 hours to pull that plug out to the point where you could remove it, remove the whole boom. And of course, the come along, the chain fall is always so handy. I think I'd like to buy a small one for myself. And so up there, that's what's coming off. That's going to be taken and repaired. Here's a guy throwing lubrication in. This is a device that they screw this and that in order to get it to pull off. Comes off, and it's going to be put on deck. And you have to wrestle with all these cables. And the cables, you know, you see on Wild Kingdom or something, there were people wrestling with pythons. But you try wrestling with these wires, it's just really difficult. You really have to man up. And there's two cranes on the side hoisting those things. And then you're moving around large timber to get it to balance just perfectly. And the crane men can't see anything. So you have this guy over here, he's going like this or up, or he's making all of these signals that you can see. And so it's interesting that you have this symbiotic system going on where you know, the man up on top is your hands. You're just trusting that he's not going to tell you to bring it down on someone's head. And then the cables are taken off. They raise it back up. They re-hook up the cables, and they remove that. And then you have the finished product that's going to be sent off to be done. Here they're bringing it down. And here you can see that the two barges are together. And there's a tug at the front, and it's hauling it while it holds it up to the dock side. This is the leftover stuff. There's it running along over to the dock. And then it goes on to a truck to take it to another part of Milwaukee that will work on it. Hey, guys. Something interesting about being, you know, we see shock absorbers, but you rarely see a piston that is so large, a hydraulic piston, and it's so shiny and smooth. Another way, there's a couple of ways you can get gear into these boats. One is you can take them through these portholes, and that's one kind of way of doing it. Another one, I don't think I have any pictures in here right now of that, but you cut a hole in the side of the ship. And you take out a huge section, and then you bring your equipment in, and then you just patch it back in. It's sort of like if you imagine your skull, take a section out, add some computer technology into your head, and stick it on. But usually when it's purification, machines or something that were in there, that other one. But here's a little sample of what these guys go through. When the equipment comes in, you have to transfer it into the ship, and so the lines that are carrying it, you have to attach things so that you can maneuver it into the bay, and then to move it along. And it takes a bunch of guys with some of the heavier stuff. Teamwork, I guess. And when they're getting ready to go, every ship had to be supplied, so we'd be hauling lots of food aboard, and maybe a carton of milk might disappear and go back to the shanty with us or something. But of course, this guy, he didn't navigate these hoses very well, and he tipped over some milk. So it's, but no one cried. We had a fire on the John G. Munson. Someone was welding on the outside. He was welding in an overflow thing that would catch ore that was dropping off the belt as it made its way up. But he had, on the other side of where he was welding is the conveyor bearing cabinet. Was a conveyor bearing a compartment, and the cabinet was full of bearings filled with grease and wrapped with grease paper, and it all caught fire. And we were rattling away with our chippers, taking rust off the bow of the boat down at the bottom, until one of us looks up, and it looked like an overcast cloud. And the cloud just sat there, and it just exited. But it was pouring out of the conveyor locker, and we ran up there, and we could get in. The smoke was about this high, and so we tried fighting it with the extinguishers that we had up front, and then the fire department was called at the time, but some of us were running the length to the stern to get more extinguishers, and the fire department arrived. Bad for the fire department, but there was an ice storm that day, and if you ever have ice on steel, and these poor guys who had never been on ships anyway, really, they're moving along, and then I'm going to try and get over wires, and because at some points the bridges that between them weren't there at the time. But anyway, you can see the expression on some of these firemen, their first joy of fighting in steel. Again, the python, wrestling with the python. The idea of pulling, and it's not unlike football. Everybody's pushing the same way, or this might be considered maybe a rugby match. And I got this end over here, and I'm pulling. I'm walking backwards, shooting. But we're stretching the cable out so that we can rewind it properly, because throughout the year, if you want to avoid tangles, you want to get everything ready. And this was just after we docked this ship, either the Spear or the Gott, and you can see that the front of the ship was all caked with ice, and the whole deck, you can see the structure, that the underlying structure that supports the deck, because it was probably warm from the interior of the ship, but the steel itself, the planking of the steel, was cold enough to have ice form on it. This fellow, a lot of work done on the conveyor belts. You can imagine how heavy those conveyor belts are. They're so thick, it must be at least an inch and a half thick or something, but they get worn out at times. But what they do is they try and repair all the patches rather than pull the whole thing out or replace sections of it. And he's working on that. There's a shot of a guy underneath. You know, do you trust a 2x4 or whatever that is pulled up with that heavy thing above you, and it's sort of like clipping toenails off the bottom of that and then repatching. And one of the things before all the crew is back, they test the lifeboats, and because the whole crew wasn't back, they needed to have everybody fill the lifeboats completely, so it gave us a chance to put make believe we were sailors, and we were just our ship went down. So we pile into the lifeboat. This lifeboat was from one of the AAAs, I think, or the AAs. And this one is from the 1,000-footers. It's got a canopy over it. This is the first time I actually have met some of the crew. This guy right over here is Crazy Menges, the one that was next to the propeller. He's laughing at me. Isn't that cute? You know, would you trust yourself? And in Milwaukee, we have those grain elevators, so there's lots of ships that come in and take corn and other stuff out through the seaway. And you know, you think, well, is this safe? I'm not sure if there's ever, if you don't have OSHA around, you don't have rules at that time, you just do what you have available. And so we needed to pull the chain and the anchor of the ship that just came in up on the dock side. And so they use this, and they're wiggling back and forth, getting this piece of wood to move over to the chain. And then they hook the chains on up on top here, and finally get the anchor on and pile the chain on the side. That, I imagine, keeps the ship's really a lot more safe than just having the steel lines out. You can tell the garbage in the river. And in the springtime, they lift the anchors up. They haul. There's a raft over here, a giant barge with a crane, and it is walking it over to the outer ship that's going to be going out, because if you drag it along the river, the captains don't like to go out with a pile of mud on its face. So they make sure that they take it up and they just pass the anchor in. One of the things, here are a couple of guys working in the conveyor tunnel. The conveyor tunnel is like 500 to 800 feet, depending upon what kind of ship it is in. It's in compartmentalized. But it has all these, like, I would call, like, little feeder nipples, where they have gates on the bottom that open and disgorge the ore onto the belt, and the belt runs to the stern, up to the boom. But the way they unload these, I imagine, and have you worked on these ships?
I have, actually. He would have a better idea.
But you have to open the gates depending upon, you know, there's a proper way to unload it, because you don't want to unload all the ore at the back end. And so you move along, and there's a sequence that they have to follow. And the gates themselves, well, right now here they're repairing the rollers that carry the belt. And here, these gates up here, when they close or open, they have steel supports in them that rust out, and they have to be cut out and new ones put in. And here are these guys, one guy is cutting and one guy is welding in a new one. Here this guy is cutting out. He's on the opposite side. Something, you know, spend your whole 8 hours on your knees, you know, ice cold, you know, it's a cold that guy with an angle iron. Here is a, we had to clear out the excess taconite from the Fairless. And the Fairless was not a self-unloader. It had, John was telling me, anyway, it had cleaned out everything, and they had, but we had to get the rest of it out because it was going to be hauling grain back up lake. I like this one just because being down on those holds, you know, your only light is coming down from like a skylight, and there's something very strange about it. And also seeing that line go up there, if you don't know what this is, you say, where is that line? Is it going to heaven? And of course, when you're cold, you find a little warmth coming in from the hold. This guy had painted his helmet gold, and I think he was trying to get a little bit more sunlight off of it. And then we washed it down. And a nice powerful hose. And it washes down in the bottom of these holds. I think there's these areas where it funnels out to an area where it can be ejected. But this is, I love this. There's a bunch of shots I took of this guy doing this, but there was something pretty, you know, reaching out and touching something that otherwise, you know, with a garden hose that is so huge, it was visually a lot of fun. There's the Callaway again, and those ships, ice. This little place up here, this is our shanty, where we report all our gear is in that area, and all the beer when the day is done. And as the snow comes, and everything freezes up, but near here are lots of salt piles, and there's salt everywhere. So even though it looks like it's wet, it could be really cold, and the salt had turned it all to water. I like this shot. How many of you guys remember that series called The Time Tunnel? Anyway, but it's written up here, danger with skull and crossbones, time tunnel. The wind was piling around one of the 1,000-footers, but they were repairing and replacing the motor on the bow thruster. And when this guy came out and peeked, he was getting spray in his face, and it was really kind of a fun shot for me. Yeah, this is in the Inner Harbor in the Kinnikinnick Basin, where these ships lay up. And when this young man was talking about they had ships that were called A, back in, I saw a photograph from the Milwaukee Public Library where we had 7 ships in here. They had, in this photograph, an aerial shot, they had 36 boats in there. And last night, the analogy came that if you can think of Christmas finger cookies, pecan cookies, all lined up and stacked nicely together, and you could walk completely across the Kinnikinnick Basin on top of these decks of these ships. Yeah, portrait. I love doing portraits. And the difference in the shapes of the ships, there's a more of a boxcar shape to the 1,000-footers, no-nonsense kind of thing, but I think that the older ships in the 30s and the 50s that were built have this sort of feminine shape to them that I really kind of enjoyed. Hello. They were getting ready to go. This was probably maybe an oilman or something. This is an interesting shot because economics demanded that they separate the holds. And this winter, they put this whole bulkhead in so that they could actually carry different forms of product, one, you know, crushed rock or coal, along with grain or maybe for going up trip or up lake, and then when they come down lake, they bring the ore back. And this is some images of these guys working on that. I can't believe it, but most of these guys, I always see them working and welding with cigarettes in their mouth. I don't know how they do it. They put it aside when they put it down, and then quickly they put it back in and examine the weld. And I think the Clark was going to be leaving early, and it was in between the two other boats, and so they had to be able to pull it out and then pull the other ships together. We had to throw cables over to the other ship with gantling and drag the cable in and then make sure that we could cinch back in while the Clark left. There's Tommy again, having fun, making believe he's captain. He's out on the wing of the Gott or the Spear, and he's making, I guess they have controls on in the center and on the sides for when they come into port or dockside. And of course, there's Menges, sort of like, putting his feet up right onto the console. Excuse me for that one over the side, but they didn't really, sometimes they gave me a hard time. And this was not too bad of a hard time, but I did get a picture of it. And again, you know, why wait to get a tug or something in there to do what you're doing? Here's a raft that was half sunk and going down. Tommy says, hook one in. I'll run out there in the water and the ice and just hook it on. And you can see pulling it up, and they were able to save this raft before it went all the way down. A couple of the guys, I don't know what his, everybody had nicknames. My nickname was Bronzel, maybe for Brozek, but Bronzel was half the world tag team match in wrestling from way back. Maybe my mate was either Killer Kowalski or Baba Brazil or. And this fellow's name was Tugboat, and he does kind of look like a tugboat. He ran a tugboat also. That was during the summer season. And this fellow, the worst job was with your needle gun or chipper, taking what you can see here is rust off the side of the ship, rust and ore dust, because we're going to repaint the whole conveyor tunnel. And some people, sometimes they sandblast that, but that creates a ton of sand that you have to get rid of and throw onto the belt where, I guess, and also the expense of Portablast bringing them in when they had us at $7.50 an hour, you know, it was better just to work us to death. But the dirt and the dust and, of all things, the sound of having these chippers move across the steel and the ringing, the sounds and the harmonics that sets up between different plates and different guys working. It was pleasurable in a way because we had earplugs and then we had earmuffs on. And so you just actually kind of like felt it in your body almost. It's sort of like being at a band and you got earplugs in, but you just want to stand next to the speaker and have the sound go through you. Respirators, there's a needle gun. The light is always so strange in there. It's just incandescent bulbs, you know. And not only that, but you're looking through goggles and then you're looking through safety glasses. And it's, you feel like you're an old person. I mean, really old in the sense that at the dental school, they have the students put these things on and tape up their hands to form some empathy for elderly for signing papers and navigating around into the wheelchairs and into the patient's chair. But that's how you felt like. You know, you were just sort of like, all your senses are taken away. And of course the goggles steam up. You're constantly trying to clean them up. This guy, kind of think of that song, Help, I'm a Walrus. This is the youngest kid, I think, that was working. I think he was the son of the wife of one of the guys from Advanced Boiler and Tank and just wanted him to get a job. Too bad he had to work doing that. But it's a lot of angles and shapes. It's sort of, if anybody loved being living in an attic with all these eaves and diagonal shapes, it was it's pretty interesting to me. Here, this underside here, this is a gate, and he's taking rust off the supports for the gate, and if he finds that the gates aren't strong enough, they'll have to remove it, which you saw them doing in the previous shots. But, you know, he's making himself as comfortable as he can. You can see the work here. Steel, paint taken up, old paint taken off with the needle gun. The visuals are, and the lighting again, are really dramatic. It's almost like Halloween. How am I set for time?
I was just going to say in a couple of minutes, let's switch over to Q&A if you can, okay?
To what?
To questions and answers.
Okay. Okay. I think we're almost done. And they're getting ready to go. And Miller time. And this will tell you when we were living. That's is that Brezhnev? No, no. This is actually Brezhnev, he made Man of the Year or something for Time magazine or anyway. These are the ships leaving, seen from the Gat, one of the smaller double A's, or the Anderson is heading out, triple A. And the bow, this is the bow thruster cranked up, pushing the bow of it out. And you see all the river mud and all the stuff it was tossing up on the side. It almost bubbled up over the side. And another one leaving. I like this. There's a little guy in there. You can't see him. But and here he's got a bunch of mud on its face from the anchor coming up. This is the last shot. And one time a fog came in and it was kind of spiritual. Any questions?
Well, first of all, let's give him a round of applause for this wonderful thing. So let's open it up for questions, and also do remember those sign-in sheets, and we'll start over here in the corner.
There's a seal, and basically, if I can, you know how you have the, when you're preserving peaches and whatever, you have something that clips on, and then you hook something over and clamp it down. You have something like that, a U-shaped thing that comes up onto it, and it clicks and snaps into place. But then you have to tighten down the top of it with screws, nuts. One nut to lock it, one nut to take it down. And so each one has, I don't know how many. And supposedly they said that possibly the Fitzgerald may not have had its hatches tied down as well as it needed to be, as tight as it needed to be, given the seas that were crashing on top of that deck. But it's a lot of work, you know. And they had ratchet wrenches, of course. But it's unless you're paying attention and unless you make sure that it's locked into place, because if it's not locked into place and you're tightening it down, it could bust away real easily. So, they're all tightened down nice and tight, supposedly. And I believe they have some rubber seal on the top part of it.
Okay, other questions, Tim?
Were these union jobs? Were they union jobs?
No. Yeah, well, for us it was, since we were just a seasonal, they called us the shore gang from the shanty, and whoever showed up to work were probably friends of Tommy's, but the down there right next to it there is Advanced Boiler and Tank that has guys that are working full time. This is their winter work, and then there's Gillen, that also does sheet piling for what did you call it, coffer dams and tough when they're putting in bridge abutments or stuff like that.
Caissons,
yeah. And so they do all kinds of stuff like that, and they have all the equipment, the cranes and things, for doing not only the stuff during the summer but also to be able to work on these ships, and they're located down there on the dock.
But a lot of those other skilled trades, like boilermakers and others, would be members of local unions in Milwaukee.
I probably believe so, yeah, but not us, yeah.
Right here?
And the crews were members of the Seafarers.
Right, yeah. It's so funny. But the one story when we were talking last night about the length of time it takes to unload ships these days as compared to the previous days, the Tommy used to tell me that the guys, the deckhands and stuff especially, complained that they didn't have enough time to go up the street to the bar anymore. Because, you know, in the old days, it was like you had 2 or 3 days to unload a ship. But now it's like 8 hours and you got to be on the ship helping to unload. So.
Okay. Bill?
What was the arrangement you had with your employer and coworkers that allowed you to be able to take photographs while you were?
Well, the arrangement was that they didn't have any say in it. Well, I guess what it was is I showed them that I would honestly shoot what I wouldn't embarrass them, and I showed them that I had been working on projects. I'd already done some harvesting for Fresh Like Vegetables, driving tractor and documenting that work environment, another work environment. I'm not sure I showed them anything, but again, I began to come to work. Tommy knew since his sister, I went to Christmas parties with Tommy and stuff, and he knew my desire with photography. So he just allowed me to take some shots, but to win them over, I started putting up on the board images of themselves, and they were kind of pleased that they were pictured in somewhat heroic kinds of images that somehow, you know, this winter job that I could be fired at any time, you know, is producing something maybe. And some of the guys actually, 30 years later, showed up when I had a show at the Grohmann Museum in Milwaukee. It was hard to recognize them, but I remember Cale, because his face did, he looked like a child. He didn't change much. And then there was this fellow that came up to me and he said, told me in a serious way, you take pictures of dead people. And one of the guys, workers must have died, and this must have been his brother. But his brother probably lived a really rough life. I mean, lots of burning the candle at both ends. Because anyway, not all sailors do that, or workers on, or dock workers, but sometimes, you know.
Tom?
About how long was the average winter season that you were working?
It would sometimes come. It always depended upon the lakes and when they froze over. But sometimes if it was really cold, they'd come in, someone would come in at the end of November and middle of December, but I saw them come in as late as January 1st, and then they would go out as early as the late March and take off, and as late as maybe first or second week in April if they had extra work that needed to be done to them.
Sal?
Well, from the bottom of the boat, I believe they're draft marks, and as they come up, they tell you how many, pardon?
It's 1 foot.
1 foot.
Between, like, the letters themselves, the letters are, or the numbers themselves are 6 inches high.
Yeah, yeah. And it was always wonderful. I couldn't believe that I'm looking down at the bottom, and it was said something like the number 6, and that only 6 feet sits below and 60 feet above, you know. And these are all heavy steel things that just...
Did you ever get to eat cooked meals?
Once or twice. In fact, as the ships would come in and the deckhands would leave, they wouldn't all just up and go. I think that basically they began to leave, and then there were some people who were in the engine rooms and stuff that stayed longer, and so the cook would continue to cook. Our favorite thing would come at break time and make ourselves pigs in a blanket with pancakes and sausages, and we'd pile those things into napkins and stick them in our pockets and head off. But in fact, Tommy, who had sailed, he said you'd never want to get on the bad side of a cook, and he said, because Tommy is a real wise ass, and he got on the bad side of this one cook, and so he served him breakfast of sunny side up eggs in a bowl full of oil.
I think I met that cook. No. Bill?
I'm applying my skills because I'm here there for my insurance.
But how are you applying?
Oh, how? I photograph everything that goes on for the dental school, which is the alumni reunions, the graduation, the incoming freshmen. Every year I do all the composites. I assemble all those things for them. I do the web page. I add images to the web page. I add content to the web page.
You're all digital now. This is...
Yeah. When I first started down there, I took the job seriously. I didn't want to do it. In fact, the first couple of years I was there, I wound up crying in the dark. I'm like, what am I doing? You know, but it was the first time I had health insurance, and so that was kind of nice. And I had a nice dark room, so I'd go to work, come home, eat, do the dishes, and head back at night and work on my own stuff. I stayed involved in Milwaukee's art community. I worked for newspapers on the side. I would use I had an agreement with my boss when he hired me. In fact, they only gave me a 3-month contract because they didn't believe I would stay around. But I talked to my boss and I said, I'll just eat away at my vacation if you just let me work on the outside whenever assignments come up. And so I continued to be a photojournalist. And as it came about, you know, as I developed as a photojournalist, those skills come back into the dental school and things I learned in terms of graphics and assembling my own work and organizing. It was a symbiotic relationship, and it still is, even though I've had different bosses who, you know, couldn't quite grasp what I meant or what I had originally going for me. But if you perform and you jump to the boss's needs, everything's pretty cool. So.
Okay. Other questions, Sal?
When does the interior paint it?
When?
Well,
that is in the wintertime. The chipping with those chipper guns was done all, it took us all one winter to do the whole thing. We were only like about 6 or 7 guys. We just move along and prepare it. We did not actually spray paint the interior. We had prepared the whole place to be, the whole conveyor tunnel to be spray painted at that point. But our job was done, and in fact, probably that was the last thing that they had done before they left that season. Our job was just everything that we had taken off the walls, we just threw onto the conveyor belt and they ran it off to the side and threw it onto Jones Island.
Okay, right here, ma'am.
There's a soundtrack with the slideshow downstairs.
Yeah.
When you were talking about how loud it was, I was very taken by the soundtrack downstairs and wondered at that point, is that the sound, and except very mildly, or?
Well, some of it, I had a show already planned of only the interior photographs, meaning the ones that are somewhat semi-blurred and dark and mysterious, and I was going to be exhibiting that, but I also wanted to take it to another dimension, and having loved the sound down there. I went down into the holds at times and recorded the guys working. So I have that sound to start with. But just having that didn't seem to be as much fun for me. So I got together with the timpanist from the Milwaukee Symphony, and we went into his basement, which was filled full of all these percussion sounds. And so we made our own sound and recorded it of what it would sound like, banging, clanking, booming, you know, things that you would hear it on any kind of construction site. You stand outside a building being built, you can hear that. And so, and then I got together with another artist and on a 4-track cassette, we blended the sounds together so that the two tracks were fading in as two tracks were fading out. And so we sat and we worked it to that point where we got a length that we wanted, and then we put it on a loop. And so that was playing on speakers as you could walk around in a contained room looking at these images. And they sort of made the interpretation of the images become a little bit more dimensional.
Okay.
Marcel? I was just gonna ask, were there many injuries?
Yeah. Well, no. Actually,
Does hearing count?
Yeah. No, there was one fellow that fell down the smokestack, and he was unconscious, and he was brought off I have some pictures of it. I'm not sure I have it in there or not, but and then there are stories of people that were killed during the winter layup. One of them, they were testing the whatever allows the lifeboats to go down. They have these winches and pulleys, and there's brakes on it and stuff. And the brake didn't work or something, and the boat fell, and the gearbox exploded and killed the guy. And then right next to us was a processing plant for scrap metal. And one day we saw an emergency vehicle arrive, and I saw these firemen carrying this guy over piles and piles of railroad ties, these poor firemen. And the guy had his feet bandaged up, and we found out later that he had one foot cut off and part of another foot. And what had happened was is they have these scrap rail cars that they put the scrap metal into, and they used an end loader just to push them along and to move them to the next pile and stuff. And one guy jumped up and he was going to crank on the brake, and he slipped off and he fell underneath it. So you have all these, you know, OSHA has brought safety, I suppose, a long way, but you know, a lot of times, in fact, in those days, I don't think that we felt that we were doing anything wrong if we were not paying attention to safety rules.
There's a young male and stupid aspect of workplaces that you always have to remember.
Yeah, yeah, there you go.
Other questions or comments? Other questions or comments for Jim? Well, let me just invite you, if you have not already seen the exhibit out down on the ground floor, please come see it. If you have the opportunity, walk over to the library to see the wonderful exhibit that Tom Volkanen has. It's a companion exhibit on the third floor. Come back on November 10th over to the library in the green room, which used to be 449A, but they renamed it the green room, redone it. It's a beautiful space. For our panel discussion in commemoration of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Michael Velbil will be talking about iron ore, Peter Kakla will be talking about iron ore shipping, and Dean Anderson, the state archaeologist, will be talking about shipwreck. So we look forward to having you at future Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives activities. Many of those were described in the flyers that went around. And please do join me in giving Jim one more round of applause. And I'm sure some of you are going to sneak up and ask a question that you didn't want to do publicly, so we'll watch you do it.
There was a question about if anybody, what have I done sort of with my photography at the dental school, but and if you want to see some of the other work I've done, I've gotten my hands into all kinds of photography in the community. I have a web page, and if you were to just Google my name, Jim Brozek, you'll get led to it. The web page URL is too long.